I have not been behind a mic in quite some time. I took a little break. I didn't tell anybody that I was going to do it. I wasn't really planning on doing it, I don't think, but it happened, and I'm very glad for it. I got married, which is, it's just as amazing as everyone says, just as hectic as everyone says, and was one of the greatest days of my life. I feel like I felt like a, you know, woodland nymph princess. I was wearing this dress from the 1930s that was just this antique, beautiful lace, you know, baby pink situation that had this really beautiful kind of scoop neck collar, but the collar and the shoulders and sort of that top area with the cap sleeves was all lace. And then underneath there was a sweetheart neckline that was a separate piece of pink fabric that sort of outlined the top of the dress underneath the lace. And I wore these beautiful sandals and just this gorgeous flower crown, and it was honestly a perfect day. And I got back after the wedding in April and realized that I had been pushing against a wall of depression that I was trying to, I think, pull myself out, or, you know, I guess if it's a wall, I'm trying to jump over it, you know, American Gladiator style. But if it's a hole, I was trying to pull myself out of it. And unfortunately, neither of those things seemed to work. And the wedding was this wonderful bright spot that anyone who struggles with depression or has gotten married can understand all of the emotions that come along with that. And I was so very elated and happy and in that high for a few weeks that when the crash came back down, it was really startling. And I am very happy to say that I had sort of a personal come to Jesus, come to Allah, come to Buddha moment with myself, which is always good when you can use the tools of therapy and kind of get to somewhere, you know, on your own, or have an event be a catalyst for said growth or whatever. And so I think just verbalizing to my husband and my close friends that I actually was sort of struggling, and not giving the stock answer of like, oh no, things are great, things are fine, I'm fine. Like, things aren't always great. And actually, things have been kind of painful lately, just in our country, globally. You know, there's a lot. And I'm not going to say that all of those things led, you know, to my depression or anything, but it definitely didn't make it easier to try to find the silver linings in days when, you know, you wake up to hear that 49 people were murdered in a club 45 minutes from where you got married, and 2 miles away from where your brother got married, and where one of your bridesmaids spent every weekend of her college career. You know, just, you hear about black men being killed in their cars in front of their girlfriends, and there are unfortunately no words for things like this anymore, because, not that we've become numb to it, but the words don't mean anything anymore. They just, if it's an experience you haven't lived, to try to tell someone that all lives matter, or that you're going to do everything you can for a community that you continually voted against legislatively, words aren't enough, you know? And so with this new season, I think the thing that I'm going to strive for in both my personal life and when talking to you guys is transparency. So right now, you know, I took a break because I needed to take a break. I finished the music video that I directed for Matt Rose, which will be premiering, I'm assuming, in like a week. I'll have the definite information for you guys pretty soon. But I am coming back to season two with all of that mindfulness sort of at the forefront of my mindfulness, you know. So that being said, same format, you know, same kind of questions, same digging into the heart of why people make what they make. But in terms of myself, it is time for me to practice a little bit of self-care in my life too. So Super Hungry the Podcast is going to be a bi-weekly podcast every other Wednesday at 9 a.m. We will be premiering a brand new episode. And I'm just going to make a general rule to be more honest with you guys. And I'd like to encourage you all to sort of feel like you could have an open dialogue with me. I do have a new website, superhungrypodcast.com. There is a sort of contact and email button there. You can also email me at superhungrypodcast@gmail.com. I really want to hear from you guys. And if there's anything you want to talk about or questions you have or, you know, anything that you feel like you're struggling with that maybe you're wondering, have I gone through it too? Because I've, you know, been out here and I'm, you know, living that dream one day at a time. So I'm just excited to be starting out with this brand new season. This episode is going to be a conversation with actually a very good friend of mine. His name is Jesse Damiani. He's a poet. He is a writer for the Huffington Post. He is a copywriter and fellow Los Angeles liver now. We went to Florida State together, where he was the editor at the FSU newspaper, where I was a writer for a couple months before I decided to quit because I'm lame. And we just had a really great conversation. We kind of run the gamut on talking about, you know, studying abroad and the freedom of getting a poetry master's, what that is like, and the challenge of Los Angeles on the creative process, but also the excitement of living in LA, and sort of what Jesse is up to now. He is the editor of the Best American Experimental Writing Anthology 2015, which is through the Wesleyan University Press, and he has a brand new book out called At Endless Spectator, The Screen Suite. And it's hashtag sweetpixbro, hashtag pixelated, hashtag loliloquy. And that's coming soon from Blaze Vox Books. And he's just a rad dude. We've been friends for a long time. He wrote a really cool article about why Walter White is the greatest television character of all time. That is on Huffington Post. You should check it out. I've got links to everything in the post on the website. So everything that we talk about, you can find there. And I'm really excited. Thank you guys for listening to my little rambling monologue, but like I said, it's all about mindfulness and transparency. I'm super excited to be welcoming back a returning sponsor for season 2 of Super Hungry the Podcast, Geek World Order. This is an awesome website, you guys. Tons of nerdy stuff. It's got reviews on movies, music, TV shows. It's got tons of articles and all the nerdy news to keep yourself in the loop. You can check them out on Facebook by searching Geek World Order and at geekworldordersite.com. Geek World Order, where geeks unite. We've got another returning sponsor to season 2 of Super Hungry the Podcast, but a little bit of a twist. We always would tell you about Hair by Kaylee Vandenberg, my awesome friend who does wedding styling. She does cuts, she does color, she's incredible. She's based in LA, but she can travel anywhere. But I'm actually going to talk to you about something a little bit different. She is working on something brand new. Kaylee Vandenberg is a writer as well, and one of her biggest goals, I think, you know, knowing her personally and also just seeing her writing career blossom, one of her biggest goals has been to inspire people. And so she started a project called The Year of the Work. And this is a project that is a little bit different. It's a monthly letter that you get in the mail, in the snail mail. It's typed out and printed and addressed to you. And it's an essay on thoughts that Kaylee has been ruminating on that month, oftentimes that reflect on her past experiences and what she's been going through. And I think it's a really empowering project. So I just wanted to take a second to shout that out and to let you know that you can check it out at theyearofthework.com. And if you're interested in supporting the project at all, she also has a donation link, and you can also buy some artwork by the really talented Brittany Shatley that is inspired by The Year of the Work at brittanyshatley.com. And all of that money goes directly to the project as well. So check that out. Lots of cool stuff happening. And yeah, lots of stuff going on. Season 2 is going to be lit, y'all. I got already confirmed guests from American Horror Story, Parks and Recreation. We've got actors from the Austin Powers series. I've got actors from the new show on CMT called Still the King. Got tons of new stuff happening for you guys, and I'm really, really excited, along with some really cool conversations with writers from The LAist and actors and models from shows like Face Off and Hollywood Game Night. So season two is really coming at you. Like I said, every 2 weeks, Wednesday morning, you'll be able to find us. Check us out on the podcast app for iPhones, iTunes, Apple products in general. We're also on Podcast Addict. Podcast Addict, not Attic, not an attic full of podcasts. Has anyone been playing Pokemon Go? I feel like I want an attic full of Pokemon. But anyway, I'm really excited you all are here. And without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Jesse Damiani. Shake it off, you know.
Shake it off, shake it off.
That wise philosopher Taylor Swift. Hey.
Hello.
Well, thank you for coming to the closet.
Thank you for having me.
How's your Sunday been?
Sunday's been great. Had a little tea.
Excellent.
Got a little coffee.
I want Trader Joe's to sponsor the show eventually, hopefully. So maybe if we say we had the ginger peach white tea from Trader Joe's, they'll be like, that girl's all right.
And it was so delicious.
It actually is really good.
No, it really is.
It is that thing, though, where maybe other people's shows, they'll give you like, oh, hey, we have vodka if you want some. And I'm like, I have Earl Grey.
Right. You would sort of corner a market, because I feel like in a podcast world, alcohol probably wins.
Right.
But if you're the tea, if you're the person who promotes tea and you corner that market, I think.
I just need to get Bigelow on board and we'll be good. I've never felt more connected to a human being than when Tina Fey was on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld. Mm. And she said something to the effect of, you know, food is always like my reward for things. She's like, if I like win an Emmy, like the Emmy isn't the treat. It's like, oh, I won an Emmy. Like, where are we going
right.
for dinner? Right. And I was like, my life. Like, that hit the nail on the head for me. And I realized that I was like sick a couple years ago, which is like why I have all the tea and I don't have the booze and like mm-hmm. I don't drink coffee. I drink Sprite, and occasionally, like, I will have some, like, I had half the amount of alcohol mixed drink at Tiki Tea over on Sunset, and was, like, pleasantly drunk, and I was like, all right, I've turned into a 17-year-old college girl again, excellent, but now I've just become that person that has all the tea.
That just sounds like, you know, fiscally responsible drinking to me, you know?
Yeah, sure. Like bang for your buck.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Nobody can top half a drink.
Nope. So you said it before, but you're from Jacksonville.
I'm from Jacksonville.
You and I met in college at Florida State, which is in Tallahassee.
The venerable Tallahassee.
Oh, God. Amount of times I've heard jokes about, like, Tallahassee, Florida in things, and it's always, like, shows that I really love and, like, sure. respect the writing, and then it'll be like, what is this, a strip club in Tallahassee, Florida? And I'm like, oh. So have they. Like they
I was
going
to say, I feel like I remember hearing about this when I
they
lived
like
there.
Have
where it was
like no topless.
Yeah, they have to. They have all these like weird rules, and you have to have it on like the outskirts of town because all the politicians and stuff. And yeah.
So weird for like a college town that has two huge colleges.
Right.
Like.
Right.
But yeah, we met through mutual friends.
Yeah.
I can never.
Well, you also worked at the SLC.
I did.
Which, that was such an amazing part of FSU.
I loved it so much. Like, it's a thing that I still talk about, and people are like, what's like your most favorite project? And I was like, well, I did this thing.
I brought
like the
movies.
Stanley Kubrick Film Festival. And it was just like so amazing. And I just, yeah, it was great to have something on campus that. Even going to other schools or meeting people from other colleges and having them be like, oh, we have an on-campus movie theater, but it's like not like this.
Right.
Like, that was always a great feeling.
Honestly, the theater in the SLC, I preferred to theaters. Like, mm-hmm. it was so good that I actually preferred seeing things in the SLC. In part, you know, the environment's great. And,
yeah.
But, you know, when it's designed to be something to screen movies as well in,
yeah.
on a college, you know, so. Yeah, FSU, I feel like, and this is, of course, like, you know, you can always mythologize and
when
fancy
you
yourselves
back, yeah.
like, oh, that was the, but I really feel like we were at FSU at the last, like, it was like everything had converged and become a really amazing moment,
yeah.
like before all the budget cuts and before like it was it like, I feel like what happened with the budget cuts is they trimmed the amount of people they could accept by half, which changes, you know, makeup just in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But it also sort of sloughs off a lot of the kids that were like, I don't really know what I'm doing, and I'm cruising, and I'm just like a weirdo. You know, it's like a lot more like type A, you know, people who are just after grades and stuff. And we were there when everybody was just like
doing their own thing.
Just lots of bizarro.
Well,
yeah.
I was going to say, because did you go in freshman year knowing what your major was
going
to be?
You know, I didn't know that I was going to become definite about it. I definitely routed around, but it ultimately stayed in the same camp.
Okay.
So I was one of the weird, but it was one of these things where I was like, oh, I want to do creative writing, you know, kind of in service of a potential film career. And then I stumbled on poetry, and poetry redirected me, but further into the creative writing thing. So, but yeah, no, a lot of people just routed around. And
we also had a connection because we both were writers for the paper. Mm-hmm. And by we both were writers for the paper, I mean, I wrote like 3 articles and then was like, this is hard, I'm done. And then you actually
get paid nothing.
You were like the assistant editor at one point, right?
I was, and then I was the news editor actually.
Wow.
So that was a whole thing, which was weird because I actually wanted to do more, and you know, I ended up blasting my way in sideways to this, but I originally wanted to write, you know, arts and life stuff.
Yeah.
And when I applied, they only had openings in the news section, so I was like, okay, I'll just do that. And then, you know, the foot in the door idea. And news ended up being much easier to write, in part because your heart's not as invested in it, because there's just other stuff happening. You're just like, okay, I just gotta like represent this well for other people. It's not like, you need to listen to this album, or do not under any circumstance listen to this album, and here's why. So yeah, the paper, that was a really, I try to describe, speaking of things you try to describe and you can't, the working at the paper and actually being in the office, because it was one of those little just sort of magical hubs of people. And, you know, we would always be working at the same time as the sports section.
Yeah.
And those of us in the newsroom prior to my senior year, because then we had an assistant editor who loved sports, and she would always sort of dish with them, and you know, sort of that made it for a different dynamic. But prior to that, when it was Autumn and Felicity and I,
none
of us cared about sports at all.
Two women who could not care about sports less.
Right. And I probably cared about sports less than the two of them.
So
you know
great.
What I mean?
It's
one of those things where it's like, I don't have like a beef with the sport. And I actually, you know, as with anything, you know, somebody who's extremely talented in their field, like, God bless you, you know.
Totally. Good for you, Yao Ming.
But the hype around sports is really frustrating, because it's like, there are people doing incredible stuff in this world. You know, there are people like really changing things, or really able to and not given the resources, because we're all, it's that like Noam Chomsky quote about how we feel these like huge problems in the world, so instead what we do is we like sort of assign our interest on like easy battles, i.e. sports, where there's not really much of a moral component, and you know, and if there is, it's sort of the narrative and the mythology of like, who's this player and what's he come from. And one of my favorite experiences in college was actually very much to do with sports, which was actually also through the communication department. There was something called Seminole Productions, which was the sports broadcasting, well, event broadcasting, but largely with sports. And the first semester I did that was football season, and I remember the way they train you, they're just like, they sort of give you a rundown of the equipment, but they're like, realistically, we're just gonna have to yell at you in the moment, you know what I mean, like, you're not going to learn otherwise. And I became such a better videographer, because like, you have to do it so quickly, like, in sports. And there's also that you realize that with either event broadcasting in terms of live, like on the boards for people in the stadium or on TV, that there's actually like a narrative being built, you know, and so you're having to learn how to help tell that story. There's all these different cameras, and the director in the studio is sort of picking which to show when and how, and it was really amazing. Like, I found myself caring about sports in a way I never, or I shouldn't say never, because of course I played as a kid, and but I cared about college football in a way I never did, because I'm sort of like hunting to try to tell this story rather than just sort of passively being in a stadium.
That's interesting. I never would have thought of it that way.
Yeah, actually, I wouldn't have either, but I have such fond memories of doing that. And like, whenever you would predict what the quarterback was going to do, and actually, because you know, when you're really close, like, you're wanting, the best way to tell a story is to have as little unused space as possible, and so you want to be tight on them. But of course, the problem in filming football is these are very fast people smashing together. So like, one, I remember one time I lost, somebody did a fake handoff, and I followed the running back, and of course, like, I'm zooming in and the running back does not have the football, and the director's in my ear like, camera 4, what the fuck are you doing, just, you know, to drilling me out. But one time I remember I just could sort of like sniff out what was about to happen, and I got this play where I just followed as tight as you humanly, like, it was like, I'm not like meaning it's like toot my own horn because it's like the one good thing I ever did in Seminole Productions. But like, I followed it at like ESPN level of good, yeah. And my directors were in the studio like, "Oh my god, you know, camera three, whatever." And I was just like, "Yeah, that felt so good, you know."
That was me.
That was me. I did that.
That intensity.
And because awesome. It's all in the moment, it's all live. You can't go edit it. There's no quality of like. There's none of this like, "Oh, I need to Google to look up what this information is." It's like you got to just do it right then and just hope that your training is. Anyway, so that's sports. That's my favorite sports experience.
That's awesome. So.
I used to be able to meow really well.
I can do it. Like... Oh, that was good.
Yeah, thanks.
That was pretty good.
Thanks.
That was good. That's almost what she sounds like, except then she has the demon scratch. I'm hoping she'll just go away. I'm glad you finished your story before she got really loud, because you were like, "And that's my story with sports." Meow.
And then I get the the cat applause.
So how long did you do Seminole Productions? For a while? A
couple of years, yeah.
Oh, cool.
So this is the great thing about media production as opposed to film, not to continue the hate speech of film, obviously, but what was nice about media production was that they forced you to take multiple sort of genres, you know?
Yeah.
So you had to take sort of your basic, here's how you use all the stuff classes, but then you had to either sort of slot into, you know, narrative classes, documentary classes, if you wanted to go the route of graphics, mm-hmm. And then sports production was one of them. And actually media production, I would say, was most the people that got really well placed and everything were often people that did sports video, because we had such a great feeder program for things like ESPN, because it's sort of this kind of training that you can't get but for a, you know, Division One.
Yeah, a huge school, you know, like good, that. Yeah.
Yeah,
our school was great, man. Like, everybody kind of always wants to shit talk it, and I always joke about how, like, you know, I got a degree in a drinking problem from there, so it's like, cool.
Right.
Everyone, I never had a drinking problem. It's a joke. But, right. like, it honestly, I have never regretted any of my time there. And even to harp on something we were talking about before we sat down, like, even knowing that when I graduated, my degree kind of didn't mean anything, I still never regretted anything because I had such an amazing learning experience.
Absolutely.
Not only just about, you know, classes, but, like, that college life and that town is just beautiful. Tallahassee's gorgeous. Like, and I think about it now, and there are a few ways I think I would go back. Like, there are a few jobs that I think that I would go out for, and if I got them, like, I would move back to Tallahassee. I think when I left, it was one of those very, like, closed book. It felt very nicely, like, bookended, like, thank you for everything you've given me, and I am ready to move on. Like, did it feel like that for you?
Yeah, I was ready to go, and not in a, similar to what you're saying, you know, I wasn't like, this has been horrible, I'm ready to get out, but it was like, I've really learned, I've really experienced what I think this moment in my life was asking for, and now I need to go to another place.
How long was it between Tallahassee and then going to get your master's? Was it right away?
Unfortunately, it was right away. I say unfortunately, obviously I love both experiences, but and everybody had sort of warned not to do that, but I ended up in this weird position where my number one option had been I wanted to go teach English in Turkey.
Oh, wow.
And the program at the time, I was waiting to hear back from, they had said they'd be back to me. You know, I applied to MFAs. I knew that I wanted to do an MFA at some point, but, you know, it's always there. But I applied to it as a backup because I'm like, well, you can't, you know, who knows where your life takes
you.
And I was really banking on this Turkey thing, and they just hadn't gotten back to anybody. They ended up getting back to you, like, 2 months after they said they were going to. They said there was going to be like April 1st. And, but I guess with Fulbright, they coordinate it like it's a country to country thing. So they don't have as much sort of centralized control to be like, tell us, you know?
Right.
But if you think about it, if you're told in June and you're supposed to start in August, that's sort of like a,
so quick.
Or maybe September, but still it was just, you know.
Turnaround.
So anyway, I applied all these MFAs, got into none of them up to a certain point, but then I got into the one school I thought, there's not a chance in hell I'm getting into this school.
Oh, wow.
Because they take six people a year,
yeah.
And so just statistically, it's not you know, likely, but so I did, and so it was sort of like, whoa, I really just didn't even expect this, and I'm still waiting to hear from Turkey, and but then they were like, yeah, we're going to fly you guys up to visit if you want to come see it, and they'd put together this sort of amazing weekend experience, and by the end of that weekend I was like, I'm going here, like, this is magic, you know, and like, this is a sort of experience that you can't miss this moment.
Yeah.
And it was a program you couldn't even defer because they alternate years, so they accept poets and fiction writers back-to-back years. Oh, wow. So I couldn't even say, oh, could I defer to next year, because the next year was going to be
fiction,
right? And because the program's so small, they actually coordinate the classes around it. It's not like there's like a set number of classes that are always happening each semester. So
I went right after. Like, amazing. Where, first of all, where was it?
Madison, Wisconsin. Yeah. And yeah, 100%.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these things where there's no, I mean, I think there's probably, in the way of college, there's just an infinite number of different MFA experiences one mm-hmm. can have, and you're only ever reporting from year one.
Right.
And I think we have different, like, somebody could have gone through my exact program and hated it, and yeah. it could have been exactly what they didn't need, and, you know, et cetera. I loved it. It was the first time I'd really been in sort of this open artistic environment where simultaneously your basic needs are met, you know, because we had fellowships where we were teaching mm-hmm. and also you're learning a lot through teaching undergrads, you know, and so you don't have to worry about going and getting another job if you don't want one, and you have very little actual committed class time, so most of your time is you figuring out what kind of artist you want to be and the structure you want to have and what your rhythms are.
That's amazing.
And coming from FSU, where I just was sort of like voraciously stuffing my schedule with things
yeah.
where I'd only have like an hour here and there to write, I thought I was this just incredible, I thought I was just this insanely productive writer where I just like every time I sit down I'm just overflowing. But then of course when you have a lot more free time you're like, oh, I'm gonna watch Twin Peaks now, or I'm gonna go do it, and you start
like,
to realize
I watched
like
all of Twin Peaks
right
now.
Exactly. Oh, and yeah. and it's hard too, because right around that moment that's when I started to think, oh, I actually might want to write for TV, like this might be, you know, what I want to do for my career job, because, you know, when you write poetry, you have to have another sort of the money job, because poetry's not that.
Poets don't make money?
As it turns out, you know.
What?
Yeah, I know. It breaks every... You know, the funny thing is...
You're lucky ladies just like poetry in general.
Yeah, I know, right?
It's not like you're like, I'm a poet millionaire.
Yeah, I know, right? Well, and it's sort of this sort of archetypal, like the sort of like slumming it poet who's, you know, got a heart of gold. Like everybody wants that to be... When it turns out, like a lot of poets are just sort of really neurotic. Like they're like a lot of poets are not what everybody wants this sort of quintessential poet
yeah.
to be, which I guess that's true of any field.
Anybody, yeah, I was gonna say, but the neuroses probably helps with the TV writing, so.
Yeah, well, and so at that time in my life, I was like, I really like this sort of long form open space, you know, because growing up, I had, or, you know, once I had sort of decided, okay, like poetry's what I love, and then I have these other things that I love, and I have these other things I have to figure out what will still allow me to write the things I love. And, you know, the idea would be it's all stuff you love, but mm-hmm. you can't go into it expecting that to happen.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, TV's awesome. And I got progressively more and more into TV, and I hadn't really spent a lot of time with TV in college. And I just went ham on TV. My first year of Wisconsin, basically all I did was I had a friend who's one of my closest friends in the world. And sort of the way that friendship took off was he approached me, you know, we'd go to workshop and then we'd go hang out afterwards, get a drink or get dinner or whatever. And he'd actually, so Wisconsin was cool because PhD students in literature could minor in creative writing, which is a rare thing. And so he actually was further along in his career. Actually, you might have read, did you read the 40 plot holes in Star Wars article?
No, but I will now.
Well, it sort of has gone viral. And so people are sort of talking about him in this different, like people who have no, yeah. So anyway, but he was further progressed in his career. He's like one of the most insanely intelligent people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And he was like, hey, how would you feel about, you know, once a week getting together and just talking about poetry? Not our own, but just like poetry and poetics, like at large. And I was like, that would be amazing. And so every Friday, like morning-ish, you know, like 11 or so, we'd get together and just like hang out for like 4 hours. He'd bring a couple books and like a couple poems and sort of like, it was like a discussion, you know, like it was an actual artistic relationship that then a real friendship grew out of. And, you know, at some point that just ended up being our conversation just as we were going about our other bit. We didn't sort of silo this time.
Right.
But so basically I was meeting with him and my mind's just like bursting with ideas for poetry. And so I'm like, I think that first semester I wrote 100 poems, which is like insane for me. You know, I don't go through sort of fits like that as frequently as other people. So I did that and I was watching like all these shows that I'd never watched. You know, I watched Mad Men, I watched Party Down, I watched Deadwood, I watched Twin Peaks. Like I basically just hunted out these lists. Like what are the shows, you know, like mm-hmm. I need to know. And so that sort of opened my mind up to just how much amazing energy was in TV.
Yeah.
And that's only proven to be more true.
Being on the set of Mad Men, not to
too much. Oh, no, right,
I did it twice, and both times it was just like, oh man, because everyone takes it so seriously, you know, and
sure.
and everyone is just so high caliber and in their field. And then I just did an episode of the middle on ABC.
Oh yeah.
Because every time I return to background acting, there's always one casting person that's like, put her right in the scene. So I'm like right in between, I'm like behind the main girl. And it's a scene where we're holding a candle and this props guy comes over to light my candle. And I had like a fucking acid flashback. I've never done acid in my whole life to 3+ years ago being on the set of Mad Men the first time mm-hmm. in the episode where Don and his second wife, Megan, thank you, with the brown hair. They go away to the Howard Johnson for the weekend, mm-hmm. and she's eating the sherbet because he's like, you like sherbet? She's like, no, I don't. And then she, like, eats it all crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm, like, behind her at the counter. I'm, like, the blob that's, like, right behind her because it's out of focus, obviously, but I'm, like, that little person. The fucking same props guy that lit my cigarette behind the counter of Mad Men lit my, like, candle on the middle, and I had this flashback, and I looked at him, I said, because he was wearing a Mad Men shirt, too. That was the other thing. I was like, did you work on the episode where you guys went away?
Is this not the first time I've lit?
Yeah, I've literally been lit by you. Yeah. And he was like, oh, yeah. Because the beauty of that show is they mostly shot at Hollywood Center Studios downtown. It was like that one location. I think it was Hollywood Center Studios or LA Center Studios. That's what it was. And so they didn't do a lot of off location things, and so for him it was so easy to be like, oh yeah, that one episode, yeah, totally, that was me. And I was like, glad you're still lighting, buddy, like, what do you say? But it was so, it was so great for me. But yeah, no, that show was really important for me. But another really important show for me that you also share a very big affection for is Breaking Bad.
Of course.
So when around that time, and to frame it for everybody who doesn't know you,
sure.
You've written for the Huffington Post for a while,
mm-hmm.
and one of my favorite articles you ever did was breaking down why Walter White was actually the most important television character of all time, and it's because of the way that, you know, and I'm completely paraphrasing you, so I want you to be able to go into it more, but you basically harped on how the slow and steady pace of Breaking Bad is what was able to give birth to the character of Walter White in the way that we're able to empathize with him, and how Tony Soprano wasn't able to do that. These other characters that we all really love and can relate to, while they had touches of that, no one did that more than Walter White. And so what was it about that show that was so appealing to you to the point that you were like, okay, Huffington Post, I have this kind of TV series I want to do. Here's this one, you know, like, what was that show like for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously there's sort of an endless number of amazing, you know, there's an endless number of things you could say about Breaking Bad that really earns its stripes. But that in particular, what you're referencing with his character, I mean, really is to me the selling point of that show, because in a lot of ways there's, you know, there's plot holes and there's all this stuff about, you know, there being sort of a finite number of characters, so the subplots can't really take off and blah, blah, blah. And it's just kind of like,
Yeah.
And you know, to me, like, everybody gets so hung up on like all these little particulars, and it's like, just how does it make you feel? Like, were you lost in it? Did you enjoy it? And I'm not saying don't be critical, because of course being critical is the other great joy of engaging with media, but some people, it's just this reflection of their own insecurities, you know, whatever. So anyway, that character, like, what you see in a lot of TV is shows will build a character that you get familiar with, and then they try to hover as closely to what that character is as possible to try to keep cashing in on that. And of course, there's a danger in not doing that, because there is this degree of, oops, sorry about that. I talk with my hands, internet. There's a danger in not doing that, because you don't want to lose your audience, and then you lose funding, and then you don't get to keep existing. But so what was so great about watching Walter White progress is that simultaneously you're seeing change happen in a way that much more mimics the way change happens in life. It's these glacial changes that moment to moment you might not even realize a change is taking place, but then when you stop and you look like, oh my gosh, 2 years ago he was totally different. Or like even the fact that season one sort of feels like a black comedy, and by the end it's this really dark thing, and it's the same person at the heart of that. And in a lot of ways what's happening is, it's not that he's changing like this other thing's being dropped on him. It's like these are pieces have always been in him, and they're slowly getting unlocked. There's he's now, I mean, you talked about feeling like with the radio stuff, you know, like you're like, I'm just, you know, I'm the snake, you know, I'm like, I'm snake in the cage, and I'm just like, I'm ready to sort of bloom out. And I think that's sort of how Walter White is, where it's like, in his chemistry teacher mode, he's an insanely intelligent person. He's also an arrogant person, and he's got these qualities that are, they're all held in a container because he siloed his life to this thing.
Yeah.
And then once there's this trigger that opens it opens up all these things that both make him, I mean, you know, you've seen the end, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Spoiler alert, internet, hit pause or whatever. But I liked it, I was good at it.
Yeah. When
that admission to his wife at the end, I think it was so vital.
And everyone was waiting for that,
yeah,
too. I mean, because I think that's the thing that makes those choices so relatable, because I feel like with each of the moments that I think you could pull out, you know, like when he's first dealing with Crazy Eyes, right? And then he finds out that his name is like Domingo, right? Mm-hmm. That's like the first murder, right? Is Crazy Eyes. And
I think so.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, yeah, no, right.
With the like, yeah, neck and the plate, yeah. Like, that's probably of all of the and there are so many moments, because you could go to these, like you said, these seminal things that they are very glacial and they're slow, but then every couple episodes I think Vince was so great in giving us these choices that Walt had to make that would change things. They weren't necessarily just the small, like, little lies that he would tell to, you know, Skyler or Walt Jr. They were these moments where he had to decide, how am I going to go in and deal with Tuco,
right,
or whatever.
Right, right.
And so for me, the first season's murder with Crazy Eyes was kind of amazing in the way that, like, he goes up and he throws away the shards of the plate. And it's that moment where he's hovering over and he realizes that Domingo, Crazy Eyes, has taken that plate shard and he's going to hide it and he's going to try to hurt him. And
that look of horror on
his
face.
That look of horror, because he knows what he has to do.
Right.
He knows in this moment what he has to become to save himself, right? Because of a previous choice he made. But in this moment, because of that choice, it's almost irrelevant.
Right.
All he has is this plate shard and how he's going to deal with it. And I loved, and I will feel really bad if it was, I don't think it was you. You didn't ever mention anything about him assuming personality traits of the people that he killed. That was somebody else.
No, but that's a big theory. I mean,
that I loved that theory personally, because, and I feel like there's so much evidence to support it, but I loved that, you know, he started cutting off the, you know, bread ends, just like, you know, like just these little things, when he started doing dressing kind of like Gus, or
like
doing same things that Gus was, how he did the towel thing like Gus did. I just thought those little moments, you would never be able to, or we hadn't before in television, had those really private moments, because even to bring it back to one of the characters in your article, Tony Soprano, it was a private moment, but it was like we were the God's point of view between him and Lorraine Bracco. It wasn't, it didn't feel like spying in a way like it did for Breaking Bad. And I loved the way that, I don't know.
Well, and also, I mean, even just building off the characters, you know, with somebody like Tony Soprano, who's an actual sociopath.
Yeah.
That's a mechanism that sort of allows, like, because, I mean, think about the moment of Sopranos. It's so early in, like, this sort of advanced literacy that a larger chunk of the population has for TV. You know, like, this was, like, when you compare this to what was on the TV, or on TV in 1999, it's insane, you know?
Yeah.
So they have to sort of play to trope a little bit more. I mean, I'm not meaning to project onto creative, you know, but you're coming from a place of, like, I don't want to just leave the audience behind, and so you take somebody like Tony Soprano, who's able to both hit this register of, like, he's always going to be himself, but for a more interesting reason than usual. Like, he's a sociopath, and so he's taking these lessons that he's learning in therapy, and you keep having this hope that he's going to become a good person as a result of it, or become a better person. And you see him even want that sort of abstractly, but what ends up happening is that he uses those things to be a better mobster, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, and it's this tragic thing you keep witnessing, and you see how depressed he is, and so you can empathize because he's a deeply upset, unhappy person who's had a hard life. And but so, yeah, the difference with the intimacy with Walter White is that he's somebody sort of bursting out of himself to change. And so when you have these intimate moments, you're seeing what we've been wanting to see from him. And there's also this just general idea, like, moving through life as people, like, there's an infinite number of lives we could lead, and different, we have these different sort of pieces in our makeup that are all sort of either sort of dormant or being sort of held at bay in an interesting way or whatever, that some things can just really change dramatically when you actually didn't really change. It's just sort of where life
put you,
ping-ponged you, yeah. You know? And there's actually a great moment in Homeland where some stuff happens between these two younger characters. They're in their teens, and they had sort of a budding romance, and this sort of pretty serious accident happens, and the way one of them acts, sort of you see the other one just not be about it. Mm-hmm. And so, as being as vague as possible, one of the characters comes up in the aftermath and is trying to sort of get their thing going again. And she just sort of looks at him and she's like, whatever we had, it's broken.
Yeah.
Like, and that's sort of a larger metaphor for the way life can work sometimes, is sometimes an event can happen or you can be asked to do something or asked to be in a place that is just beyond your control, and it activates pieces of you that are now, you can never undo that. You can never have those put back, or you can never not know these things about yourself. And this is why we make art. These are the moments you make art for, you know. It's right. Like, this is why life is complicated. So, yeah, Breaking Bad's great. Everybody should watch Breaking Bad.
Right now. It's all on Netflix. Go. Yeah. Go. So, what are you watching right now that you're really into, TV-wise?
What am I watching right now? I just watched a new season of Transparent.
Good.
Fucking masterful.
I need to watch it.
It's really... And season one was really good. Yeah. Season one sort of... took a concept that I think a lot of people were going to call, you know, like sort of a token buzzy sort of thing, and it found a way to present it to you that really just felt like an earnest depiction of its own story. And I think season two, what that made way for was that season two is like, okay, we got you ready.
Yeah.
And now we're going to gut you. Like season two is when all the things start, like all these irons that have been put in the fire, it's just, everything's heating up so hard and they're all coming into combustion. So it's just, I'd recommend it to anybody.
Okay.
Prior to that, I watched Rick and Morty. I think Rick and Morty is probably the funniest show on TV right now. And it's weird because it's a cartoon, and like Archer has sort of reinstigated this, like, oh, cartoons can be as funny
and
as live action.
Bob's Burgers,
yeah, of course. But I guess I mean more like, you know, because now we have F is for Family. Like a lot of these more intentionally, like they're sort of in the mode of an Adult Swim show without the sort of zany absurdism that appeals to only a subset.
Right.
Where Rick and Morty has that, but it's tapping into like the Doctor Who meets, you know, Back to the Future kind of dynamic. And it's asking you to confront really difficult, like, the pieces of sci-fi are actually, like, really difficult questions of humanity, you know?
Yeah.
It reminds me of Red Dwarf, if you ever watched Red Dwarf.
It's like that British sci-fi show, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Brittany was really into it. My old roommate was really into it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Callback, FSC.
Hey, so, you were in Wisconsin.
I was in Wisconsin.
Didn't you do some, like, studying abroad, right?
I did. That wasn't Wisconsin. That was college.
Before.
So I went to Spain for a summer, and then again, as to singing FSU's praises, we had an actual study center in Valencia, which was it wasn't autonomous from FSU. It was a part of FSU,
but it was operated.
But it wasn't even a sister. I mean, you took FSU classes, and like when I ended up, so I worked there the next summer because you've gone and you sort of know what's up. Every year they're hiring, or every semester they're hiring, basically some mix of like an RA and a liaison between the Spanish staff and American students. So I actually got to go twice because there was this job opportunity, which, you know, was really, really incredible, and that, you know, life-changing. And I try to force everybody I know to study abroad at whatever financial cost they can possibly handle. Because, you know, the thing that we were taught, I loved it so much I became a student recruiter for international programs.
Yeah.
And the thing I'd always say, and that I just really believe, this isn't canned, you know, is like, eventually you'll have the money to pay off whatever a study abroad experience will cost you now.
Yeah.
But you won't be able to ever replicate what it is to go study abroad. You'll be able to backpack again, you'll be able to vacation again, but you'll never be able to be around a bunch of people in your same exact position in this sort of fairyland, like, amazing little nest. Because it becomes a second home, unlike backpacking, which I love backpacking too, but the thing of backpacking is you're just like bouncing, and you're always sort of keeping things contained, and you know where in the hostel you want to stash your stuff, and you know, like, all these little pieces. Whereas study abroad, it's like, oh, I'm home. You know, and it's a very different thing. But yeah, Spain was great. Wisconsin was also great, but weather-wise, obviously, the exact opposite.
Seasonal depression is a motherfucker. Yeah. I hated it. I thought it was fake until I moved to Michigan, and then I was like, oh,
yeah,
this is terrible.
Well, I found actually L.A. has it pretty bad, too, because of how early the sun goes down. It's also a matter of expectation. In L.A., you're like, oh, it's sunny, it's amazing all the time. But then actually what happens in the winter is there are a few chilly days, and more than that, the sun's going down at 4:30, and you're like, L.A., why are you doing this to me?
Yeah, it starts to get dark, and you're like, I can't, what's happening? Like, I need to do things. Like,
don't leave me.
Well, it makes me feel like I can't go certain places, like, unattended, like, without an escort.
Without a chaperone.
Yeah, like, even when we were leaving your party the other night, and you were like, I'll walk you guys down. I was like, I've seen your neighborhood. I'm okay with that. And it was two of us. It was me and Steven. And you were like, I'll just walk you down. Just, I was like, all right, I appreciate that. Like, just because I feel that way at, like, 5 o'clock now. I'm like, what's everyone doing? Gonna drive there? Like... And I hate that because I actually really like taking the train and like walking and like doing stuff like that.
Right.
Fuck winter.
Well, and also, I mean, not to take it to a dark place, but we are in a weird moment in the world in for just a whole lot of reasons. But obviously the biggest, I mean, I guess this is all arguable, but you know, like climate change is really wreaking havoc in more ways than people are, you know, everybody's like, oh, you know, we'll sort of tighten our belts, you know, we'll figure it out. It's like, no, you don't understand. Like, all that stuff in Syria is, like, that's climate change. Like, that's water shortages. Yeah. That's, like, arable land being destroyed. And so we're in this moment where the seams are really starting to show, and it's starting to eat its way up from the bottom, where a lot of people who traditionally have had enough are starting to not have enough. And what we do as people when we don't have enough is we get desperate. And desperation takes a lot of different forms, and for some people, it is as simple as moving through your day, putting off a really dark, harsh energy because you're feeling desperate and you're lost in your stuff. And just more people feel that way now. Yeah. I mean, and some of this, you know, we're in our, you know, mid-20s existentialism, return of Saturn, like all these things. But it's like, I also just really think that's true globally. You know, I've been to several different places this year and I feel it, or I guess this, 2015, I mean. But even in places that I've known to be sort of these idyllic, you know, strongholds of peace and harmony have this undercurrent of like, oh, a lot of people can't afford their lives right now. And so there's this feeling, especially at night, you know, when the lights are out and when there's fewer people around and everybody's feeling this, I think even if it's not that you're expecting a bad thing to happen, you're not moving through with the confidence of it being fine.
Yeah.
And so that's the slight change that yeah, because I used to love walking around at night.
There's not even ground emotionally to
exactly
to be standing on. Yeah.
Exactly.
That's an interesting way to think about it too, but it actually kind of it makes sense a lot because I feel like there are so many things I'm reading lately, so many friends of mine, even in my own personal dialogue in my life, like LA's hard. Like
for sure.
Like, you know, affording to live out here is difficult. Affording to be a person out here is really difficult, and so it makes you think of other lives you can have.
Right. It's yeah. Just,
it,
yeah.
I like a lot of the things that you've said. I feel very strongly lately, and especially with being in flux and all of that, I feel like our generation, like I had said before, even is. It's like we had these weird expectations put on us by the previous generations with no actual tangible way to get any of the results in a timeline that's satisfactory to them because we were caught in almost like the Ponzi scheme of the bachelor's degree where sure. you like have to have it. It's the new high school diploma in a way. But at the same time, you get out here and as a filmmaker, like some people, you know, assume you go to film school, but then other people are like, oh, you didn't go to film school. That doesn't matter. Like, right. Oh, that's cool, because it really doesn't once you get out here. You realize that.
Right.
But that feeling of, like, if I don't go do this and pay for this thing that I really can't afford because it's exponentially more costly per credit hour to afford college now than it is, and the cost of living is so much higher, and the, you know, standard rate of wage is pretty much similar. And so when everyone gets down on all these like $15 an hour people, I'm like, I am with you, I guess, in the fact that I think that maybe not everybody, you know, deserves $15 an hour. But if you're trying to moralistically tell me that it's wrong for someone to make a livable wage, like I cannot get behind that.
Right.
Like I really can't. And if you look at the numbers, like a single income household that is working at any of those jobs full time can't afford to just have their basic needs met in this country. And that to me it's that dialogue should be, and absolutely. That, you know what I mean? And so for, I, and not to get like super political or anything like that, I don't even really want to harp on it, but like, that's why when all of these primaries and these debates are happening and stuff like that, I'm like, who is really looking at that picture? Who's right. looking at sort of these macro issues in a way that, that makes sense and isn't trying to vilify people,
right.
because I think that that's so much of the dialogue.
Right.
It's just, no, it's their fault. Like,
right.
which is fine, because, you know, sometimes that works if it's somebody's fault, but if it's just a thing that has happened,
right.
and we're trying to find someone to blame, that I can't get behind.
Yeah, no, I actually, this, so two things. One's a quick thing and one's a brief story to hit your point. I actually have been saying to people, like, I really feel like we're in... Did you ever hear of or see any of the Left Behind series?
Yes.
I feel like we're coming up on that election where it's the Antichrist versus the Savior. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like you have, like, Bernie and Trump, which, like, whatever you... I mean, just the generosity of spirit you find with Bernie and just the just utter horrific... xenophobia.
Deep,
and yeah, yeah.
I
mean, he just... And he just... And Trump also just... He just does not... It's just all a game to him. He just it's as if he's a god and he's just screwing around with the peons, you know.
Yeah.
And so yeah, so it really does feel like we're like approaching this really pivotal, like, and, you know, we laugh, but like if Trump gets elected, that's
not funny.
A huge problem.
No, it's actually not a funny thing at all. Yeah. It's quite terrifying.
Yeah, but then the other thing that you sort of hit on as to like the minimum wage question and stuff like this is like, I wish there were a way that we could up the minimum wage without that trickling up to the top to where that just becomes the new, like, $15 becomes the new $8 an hour.
Yeah.
And one thing to sort of hammer this home about how sort of dystopic certain elements of our society are right now is a couple months ago, I don't know if I had told you about this, but I ended up at a Deaf Heaven show. I smashed my face. I broke my face in a few places. And at the time, I didn't even really, and of course, it's like even just like, sort of a goofy position of privilege to start in that, like, I'm putting myself in pits at metal shows
right.
and then that's how I, you know, break my face or whatever. But I ended up having to go to the ER and it was this overnight thing and I needed to get a CT scan and, like, all the things that sort of come with that. I think it's getting worked out better, and I know it's a bit of a faux pas to talk about this, but to hammer this point home. So that's, my face ended up being, like, fine in the sense that I didn't need any reconstructive surgery.
Okay.
Obviously, it wasn't fun in that I needed to let it heal and everything else.
Stitches, all that?
No stitches. Like, literally, no part of my face was broken open. It just, the collision had, like, it was one of those miracles of science where it just, like, imagine, like, an egg, like, just the perfect little ray, like, hits
like
the shell of an egg.
Yeah,
it just crackles
it,
but nothing actually moves. The bill for that, which, again, no stitches.
Yeah.
No surgery, just 9 hours in an ER.
An overnight stay.
Yeah,
right?
But I wasn't even, you understand, I was in the waiting room. I waited for 4 hours. And again, I'm not, everybody goes through this. This isn't exclusive to me, but like this experience is like just dystopic in the beginning because hospitals are, you know, sort of dark, scary places. And
mm-hmm.
we think of them as these like sort of gleaming, you know,
white
towers of cleanliness.
Yeah.
And in fact, they're just really dirty and often really sort
kind of
overly
sad,
taxed workers
cold.
Who can't keep track of
yeah.
Did it. And so it wasn't even a big procedure.
Yeah.
And the bill before insurance was closing in on $10,000. The bill after insurance was $3,500. Now, again, like I said, I'm hoping to sort of work this all out a different way, but and I bring it up to say, like, I'm in a position where I have a job, and even if it were to be $3,500, eventually I'd sort of figure that out. No, it's fine. You know, eventually
you
I'd work that out.
I'd
whatever. But I'm thinking, like, because you're in the hospital with a bunch of people, it's like single mothers with their sick kid, you know, and it's like, you're trying to, like, make a whole family. Like, we shouldn't be in a position where a small injury is that costly because that's literally going to bankrupt somebody, you know? And
there was a statistic that Stephen was saying to me because, again, I'm getting married. No, but he was saying that any sort of $400 expense could, for, like, a majority of people can completely, like, an unexpected, like, $400 expense can completely screw up their finances for a time because so few people have the ability to actually pay, you know, more than 1 month's rent in a row. And, like, I realized that that was like the goal. One of the goals that I like have had for myself is like, I want to pay a few months rent in advance. And like, that's such, when you really think about it, I'm like, that's not that big of a deal, or it shouldn't be.
Right.
But then I live in LA, so it's right. kind of a lot of money.
Well, it's the trade-off of, and this is, I mean, you know, there's a very definite moment where you decide you're going to do LA or not do LA. And it happens once you're here. It's not prior. You know, it's like you
it's
really
actually,
yeah, exactly. It's just la, you know, everybody, you know, but that's what it is. And LA does a terrible job marketing itself, or maybe it's a great job depending on how you see it. But like, I feel like my impression of LA was largely Hollywood and in particular, a very specific subset of caricatured Hollywood.
Yep.
When I got here, I was just like, I couldn't believe, like, I've actually fallen into this other route where even though I'm still pursuing a Hollywood angle, mm-hmm. my life largely consists of traditional artists who are doing an artist hustle, you know, painters, musicians, you know, these writers. And there's just such a swell of that energy right now. And there's so many people doing that. It's so amazing. And it's like, that's getting no traction outside of this city. Like, if you're not in this city, you don't realize that's happening.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, shoot, I forgot what I was saying.
L.A. is a good art hub.
Oh, yeah, right. So, but as to affording it, you get to live in L.A. You know what I mean? You get to be in this magical place with, like, I remember I was living in this complex, and the people across the way were comedians, and they're actually good friends of mine. And they were like, oh, yeah, we're going to this drag show in Eagle Rock. And I was like, do you want to come? And I was like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
And it ended up being one of the, like, coolest, most, like, even from, like, a rhetorical standpoint, like, the way that gender fluidity was playing out in a drag show was something that I expect I probably really could only have seen. Like a dive bar throwing a drag show that was packed to the gills, where you're seeing queens with like blue mustaches and leotards and songs they wrote themselves. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not, so there's so many people doing so many things that ideas are flourishing in really fascinating ways. So that's the plus side. The downside is it's going to just gut you for that. You know, like even though it's cheaper than New York, it's still too expensive, and just having to drive everywhere and everybody always wanting stuff from you and everybody asking for things.
It changes the dialogue you even have about yourself. And I think when you realize, you start talking about yourself differently, like you start leading with like, this is who I am. Oh, and this is what I do.
Right,
and it's like the second thing you say, like one of the most freeing things to me after I got laid off was just being like, well, I'm
fun employed.
This is what I'm doing right now. Yeah. Or like, I'm working as a part-time like assistant. You know, like that to me, to not have the pretense of like, you know, and I realized that I think it was just a shift in my brain, because I'm still doing all of the things that I was doing last year before I got laid off, except for working at that particular company.
Right.
But before I used to be like, well, I'm a producer and like a writer, and I'm like directing my first music video soon. And, you know, I like, and I do a pod, you know, and now I'm just like, well, I work for these designers.
Right. The transition from like, work for to the title.
Yeah, you know what I mean? I literally, but that's what I started. I just let off with that, and I realized that that is so freeing, because it's not anything about expectations of other people. It's just purely of expectations of myself, because you almost, in a way, when you lead off with that, it's like you have nowhere to go but down.
Right.
Because if you start off with what you think is like the best part of yourself or like the most interesting thing, and the person next to you, who inevitably will one up you fucking no matter what, they've done it and they've been there and it's cooler, like you kind of just immediately get deflated and you're like, well, that was it, that was all I had,
right? That was my ace.
Like, that was my and so for me, even more than that, is it's, I feel like the dialogue is different here. And it, that's not to say obviously that you can't have amazing, meaningful relationships and conversations and moments with people and experiences. And I do think part of what we pay for is, you know, I can go see a $5 comedy show that Zach Galifianakis is going to show up at and do a new set, or Aziz Ansari, or, you know, all these people that I've actually seen for that much money at UCB, you know, like, so you pay for these things. But I think for me, oh God, I'm in such a transition right
such
now.
A spot.
Yeah, just because I think about it and I think about these other goals that I have for my life and how many of them I've completely let atrophy, like how many of these talents or wants or desires, like how many things do you have to compartmentalize away to exist here?
Sure.
You know, to do the hustle, to make your one, the one dream that is why you're here come true, you know? And so it's an interesting place, because I never really thought that I'd feel that way. And it was like, before, when you were saying you thought you wanted the one thing, and then you started kind of getting into poetry, and, mm-hmm. and you didn't know really how you felt about it, because you would always kind of, that's, you know, that's, I think, such a touchstone for me right now, because,
yeah.
you know, like, it's hard when you're going towards one goal for so long to have doubt with yourself, because if other people doubt you, I think it's easy to defend yourself, because it's what you've been doing. It's the default.
Right.
If you start doubting you, you're like, oh, wait, am I just pussying out? Or, like, do I really
right.
not want to do this anymore? And that's...
Well, and it's harder, as to that end, it's harder to pick a priority singular. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Because you're in a place where so many people are doing things that are exciting. I think of it as sort of like unchecked electricity. And so it's like you can drop into this, like, bolt of electricity and 2 months later emerge from that and be like, I didn't write a single word on my screenplay.
Yeah.
Like, I've written some random scribbles, and I've painted a lot, and I've hung out with some really weird people I never thought I'd hang out with, but I haven't done anything of what I came out here to do.
Yep.
And then you're like, okay, I'm going to get to it. And then you ping pong another way, and it's like the barriers you have to put up to sort of silo a priority are much harder here, just because there's so much stuff. It's not only that, because, you know, any place has a lot of things going on. It's that, like, in any other place, that one thing would be, like, the highlight of your month.
Yeah.
And that's every single night. Like,
yeah.
you can go to a thing that will be, like, the kind of thing you could tell a story about, and that's just a Wednesday.
Yeah.
And that's hard. That's hard. And it also takes it out of you financially if you're not careful, because then you're like, you know, you have to do the whole song and dance of, like, well, if I'm out, I got to eat a little food, and
yep.
food turns into a drink, and then you're out longer, and then you have a snack. You know, so it's like wait,
you
I just
Uber
burned
home,
40 bucks.
Or,
yeah, Uber
yeah.
home, whatever. And it's like, I could have just written tonight. You know
yeah.
what I mean? And so that's been the thing. You know, I've been here for a little over a year now, and that's really what I feel like, you know, in terms of New Year's resolutions. You know, it's never really a thing, but for me at least. But this year I'm saying, like, I'm sort of putting on the blinders a little more, and really sort of putting my nose to the grindstone.
I think that is one of the good things about LA, is that that attitude is so welcome. Like, you can find people who, on the opposite side of the coin of wanting something from you, you can find people who are doing the same thing, even if it's not the exact same thing, they're out here with the same intention. So you can have really good friendships with people you might not see all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's such an interesting city in that way,
mm-hmm.
which is, it's changed my social habits
sure.
dramatically, because I think everyone, yeah, because survival is so key here. You have to be focused on yourself in a way. It's like a shark. Like, you have to keep,
right.
You gotta keep moving, you know? And so, like, I wonder in this past year, what has been, if there has been one moment, like, what has been the moment that you were like, either, I'm gonna leave because this is crazy, like, LA's crazy, like, why did I think I could come here? And then probably on the other positive end, you know, have you had a moment since coming here or before, you know, because
mm-hmm.
it was any of the other times, like, have you had a moment that was like, okay, this is why I'm, you know, like, supposed to do this, like, this shining thing is the thing that I keep inside, and it's
jewel.
That light that I let just burn a
yeah,
little
yeah.
bit, you know. So let's start with the sad, and then end
right,
with the happy,
exactly.
so you don't leave and want to kill yourself.
Right,
something.
Exactly. Like, oh, well, thanks for having
thanks
me.
Thanks for having
yeah,
me. This was great.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, in terms of the sad, I don't know that I really have had one defeated moment. There have been moments, I actually have a really great job, but of course, jobs are jobs, and there are going to be times.
You're a copywriter right now?
I'm a copywriter.
Excellent.
I write trailers and TV spots and creative content.
For the movies?
For the pictures.
For the motion pictures
yeah.
and the television?
Yeah. And even a chunk of movies that I really like and believe in, you know, and so it's...
Are there any that you can talk about, name drop now that they're done, or...?
Yeah, I don't... I think I've still been here new enough that just for safety... What I'll say is that...
LA makes you scared.
I know,
it's job,
like,
you'd be like,
I signed an NDA, I gotta know.
Like, I put granite counter over on Palm Drive. Like, any other job, you're like, let me show you pictures.
Right. Well, and my suspicion is that it's fine, but
no, it's
but just to be safe,
yeah.
what I'll say is... major animated movies are sort of have sort of been our, at least the company I work for, that's been their bread and butter.
Excellent.
And so those are the campaigns I end up working on, which often have a lot of at base positive sort of things to say,
which is nice,
you know, which
it's
is
a
nice.
Good feeling, you're not putting out shit into the world,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
But like any job, sometimes it's really overbearing, and there's lots of beyond the just base amount of time, which again, with LA, like, sometimes you have to pull really long hours for work because it's, even at the top, you know, I work for a business, so I ostensibly work for a 9-to-5, but even they are project-based. And yeah. So they're like, we need you in tonight. You know, we're trying to put together a pitch for tomorrow morning. Like, we need you in tonight. And it's, you know, you want to sort of measure up and do well. But there have been chunks of time where basically everything was kind of converging, where it was like, I felt like, as to not being able to keep up with friends as much, like your sort of social group, you sort of drift, when especially when you're sort of tunneling in your own stuff, and then work sort of piling on. And it's that moment of just feeling blitzed out, like your brain can't just rest and be still. It's like from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to bed, you're electric, you know. Like, electricity really to me is the image to describe the way things move in Los Angeles.
And so
there have been moments like that where I'm like, this is blitzing my brain out and making me emotionally crazy. My life is fine, but the way I feel is really, I mean, you feel sort of like you've just been plugged into a wall and never had a chance to not be plugged in. But what that does is it asks you to really learn what your mechanisms are and how to sort of circle back. And so that's really what I've, like, regardless of how long I stay in Los Angeles or whatever else, those are mechanisms I'm glad to have in myself and I'm glad to be building in myself. I'm certainly not there. But so when I've felt really alive in Los Angeles, again, I don't think there's like, or rather there's probably a whole network of individual moments where I'm like, yes, you know, you know, this place.
Dreams.
Yeah, exactly. Really, really brief aside, and not to do the classic, you know, but LA is sort of a muse for me right now. You know, I'm also working on a novel that I was inspired to write because of the life I was having in Los Angeles. And I've never really wanted to write something that was even semi-autobiographical. You know, my slant is always to want to go for something at a remove from myself that bears the pieces of me sort of behind a film, pun intended. Oh my gosh. Did you hear that?
That's all your stomach?
That's my stomach.
Continuing that long?
Yeah, that's...
Drink some tea.
LA just works me up.
I wonder if that just, like, got picked up on the microphone.
I hope it did. Otherwise, we just sound like crazy people.
It was a gurgle, you guys.
It was a gurgle.
It's pretty pronounced.
It was a great gurgle, too, if I may.
It was cartoon style.
If I may toot my own
style. Yeah, there were fluctuations to it, for sure. So you were saying LA, it, like, makes you...
So just in terms of leveling up in yourself and figuring out who your people are and who you want to be here. And there's been one person that I do work with consistently out here. You know, I'd say writing partner, but like, we're homies.
Yeah.
We do other things. So, you know, it's sort of just like a long form friendship with different
aspects.
Little pockets. Yeah. And there have been moments when we would, he had been involved. He did his MFA in film at USC.
Cool.
And so, we would go into classrooms at USC and use the whiteboards and just sort of brainstorm. And there was a chunk of time for about a month and a half or so where we were going probably 5 days a week for 4 to 5 hours a day, just plotting different things. I mean, I think we came up with like 20 different, you know, ostensible ideas and a few different sort of working things ranging from pitch to treatment, and then just sort of picked like, what are we going to try to move forward with? That's when you're like, this is why I'm here. You know, you feel like it's the way people describe being really on it with working out. You know, it's like you're getting sore, but in a way that feels great when you go to bed, and you're getting up and you're just like hungry to do that thing.
That's like the best way to describe it, because I never understand people working out.
And I know,
I'm like,
right?
Oh, but I get it with this, because I could do like a 15-hour day, like no problem.
Right.
So what advice would you give to people who are either, you know, thinking about moving or live in another city where they're just trying to, you know, be like a working artist, you know? Like, do you have any advice?
You know, I'll answer that by parroting some advice that was really great that I heard.
Excellent.
From a podcast, no less.
Hey.
The WTF episode, the sort of iconic Louis episode on Marin's podcast. He talks about how, this is like this like lineage of advice because, he was parroting somebody having said it to him. But and I don't remember what major film, maybe it was Francis Ford Coppola, it was one of these like bigger sort of iconic filmmakers, had said, don't wait for funding, don't wait for things to get into place, just start doing it. Just start doing whatever the thing you're doing is, and the other pieces will fall into place. And that's what really motivated Louis to start making the short films and ultimately the feature, because, you know, he did Pudutang.
Yeah. Classic.
Although there's a whole, you know, if you listen
to the whole... I was way too young to watch that when I watched it. Did you watch it at a young age?
No.
I watched it... when I look back, I'm like, that's an adult film.
Right,
like,
that's a little bit
above.
I mean,
not porn, but that's like an adult's movie.
Right. Yeah.
Well, that's good advice, though. Like,
that's what's been really great for me is, like, just when I feel like I'm sort of like spinning with ideas and things and just can't sort of get a hang on like what's my sort of individual life, is just start doing it. And that's why Caleb, his soon to be released
secret project.
One thing that it induces, and you know the internet will know more of this in days to come.
Insiders.
Right, I know, or so. Is it asks you to turn that critical part of your head off that wants you to edit, like, you know, you're writing something and you sort of write a little bit and you're like, oh no, I want it to sound right and whatever. And it sort of, it turns that critical part of your head off and it's like, just go. Just put stuff down, edit later. And that is metaphor for how you live your life. For a lot of artists, I think, is really important. And I think I'm one of those people who needs that repetition.
I like that. Good structure.
Yeah.
Well, this was fun.
This was a lot of fun.
We've been in here for a little while now. It always ends up with, like, I sit down and I'm like, oh, this doesn't feel like that long. And I'm like, it's been an hour and like 15 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Now. Yeah.
Well, you should edit it. You should just like randomly put things I'm saying in relation to other things that have nothing in common.
Yeah.
Just edit it to where it's like...
I've been really trying to build a theme for the podcast, so randomness, sure. I think,
just
will
just total
be
absurdity.
Just, yeah, that'll be great.
Right, we'll mix, like, How to Survive in L.A. with Donald Trump.
Yeah. How to Survive in L.A. You'll be like, well, here's my advice. I think if he gets nominated, it will be a joke. Not a joke. So, do you have anything coming up that you want to let the internet know about? Do you want to let them know where to find you? I find that people on the internet... they talk to each other.
They do.
They know how to use the websites.
They do. I'm in the process of making a website.
Hey.
Which will be myname.com.
Excellent.
So I'm hoping that sort of comes out on the quick. In the meantime, I'm on Instagram.
Excellent.
As Endless Spectator.
Excellent.
My anthology, or not my, but our anthology just dropped. Literally last week.
Awesome.
So that's on Amazon.
What's the name of
that? It's called Best American Experimental Writing 2015.
Awesome.
It's awesome. We were with a new press that's really incredible. The guest editor, like everything about this anthology is just makes my heart sing. So
okay.
I hope people...
Well, I'll link it on the post too, cool. So people will know how to get to it. Then for people who want to read any of your writing, they can just search Jesse Damiani Huffington Post get all your television series. And
yeah, yeah.
Like
so
that.
That's just the... Do you remember the site? Let me Google that for you. Let's just send that.
Yeah.
Where it just types it in for you. But yeah, so I don't... That's why I need a website, because nothing of mine is really centralized well right now. And I've been really averse to having a website, but now I'm like, no, it's time. I have way too much stuff floating. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure if you just type in my name,
cool.
I think there's only one other of me in the world, and
really?
he's very... He's like a religious zealot.
You definitely have to kill him.
Well, you know, it's a touchy subject.
Hey,
but, you know, a friend of mine will always post things that this person does on my wall.
And say, like, congrats
and be
and
like,
stuff.
Yeah, he'll just be like, you know, I didn't know you were such a believer and stuff. And so, I'm like, I was raised Catholic, so that's
You know that
trauma.
You should just write and you need to interview him, right?
One day I do hope to.
That actually could be really interesting.
Because, I mean, how many Jesse Damianis? I mean, it's such a weird...
It is a very
You know what I mean?
Name.
It's a weird...
I thought that I was the only Virginia Anson Gruber ever in
mm-hmm.
existence, and held on to this uniqueness for a really
sure.
long time.
Came
there
undone.
Was one other. But she's dead now, so
oh.
I'm the only one now. But
I feel like congratulations is
Yeah,
in
I'm like
order.
The reigning one, but like...
The reigning.
There was still one before. I'm still the sequel.
You are the sequel. But you could be the Empire Strikes Back sequel.
And not Too Fast, Too Furious?
Oh,
Too Fast, also Too a good Furious. Sequel, though.
I actually don't remember Too Fast, Too Furious.
Shame on you.
I know. I remember Ludacris did... what was the big song for that?
Was it
Move?
Stand Up? Or oh,
maybe
yeah,
it was
maybe Move.
Was it Move? It was... Or no. Oh, man, this is going to bother me.
By the way, Stand Up and Move sound a lot alike, too.
It's true.
Like,
it's true.
Stand Ups. And then I was like... Oh, they could kind of almost be in the same, like, back-to-back.
I almost want there to be a medley of Ludacris songs now that are all just, it sounds like it's invisible that it's even different songs put together.
I hope that there is one, and if there is, that will be on this post as well. Done. Boom. Well, thanks, man. This was super fun. Thanks for coming in.
This was a ton of fun. Thanks for having me.